Congratulations! You have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lambcast. This is episode 723, and I'm your host, Richard Kirkham, from Kirkham A Movie A Day and the Strother Martin Film Project. This week, it's time for the Movie of the Month for February. A tradition was started several years ago that the hosts of the show would submit films for their birthday months, and since I'm a February baby, the choices this month were all mine. I decided to offer 7 blind spots so that whatever film was chosen, it would be new to me. 2 of the films didn't get any votes whatsoever, but we had a close contest at the top, and Martin Scorsese's dark comedy from 1983 was selected by the community after a close contest with the Coen Brothers movie on the list. Volunteering to join the show before a film was selected are 3 brave lambs who will discuss the film with me today. It looks so simple to the viewer at home, those things that come so easily, that are so relaxed. It looks like it's a matter of just taking another breath. It takes years and years and years of honing that. Todd Liebenau from the Forgotten Filmcast has done the work. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
At least once in his life, every man is a genius. I'll tell you something, Matt. It will be more than once in your life for you. Matthew Simpson from Awesome Friday Podcast.
Oh, what a great introduction. I don't know if it's true, but I appreciate it.
If your name is not on the list, we cannot let you in. These are the rules and regulations of this place. Nick Rehack of Lyrical Innuendo, your name is on the list.
Hey, for once.
Well, all of you guys are on my list for being with us this week. I appreciate it. Rupert Pupkin is obsessed with becoming a comedy great. However, when he confronts his idol, talk show host Jerry Langfield, with a plea to perform on Jerry's show, he's only given the runaround. He doesn't give up, however, but persists in stalking Jerry until he gets what he wants. Eventually, he must team up with his psychotic, Langford-obsessed friend Marcia to kidnap the talk show host in hopes of finally getting to perform his stand-up routine. The king of comedy is Martin Scorsese's financially unsuccessful film from 1983. Well, we're going to start with firsts, and my question is, was this a blind spot for anyone else? And if not, when did you see the film first? And what was your first impression? Nick, let's start with you.
This was not a blind spot for me. I saw this a handful of years ago. I can't remember when, but it up until then it was a blind spot. And I'm like, oh, I should really watch this movie. And I finally sat down and I watched it. And to be honest, I didn't care for it. So I was really interested to watch it this time around to see if my opinion would stay the same or if it had changed and why.
All right, and we're going to find that out in a few minutes, I assume.
Yes.
Todd, how about you?
Not a blind spot for me either. I'd seen it a few years back. But, yeah, this is really only my second full watch through it before. My impression was different than Nick's on the first time watch. I enjoyed this film the first time, and I enjoyed it again this time. So.
Okay. And Matthew, what was your take on this?
It is a blind spot for me. I had, to be fair, I had seen like the first half a couple of times because I've tried to watch it a number of times and never gotten all the way through it for various reasons. So this is my first time sitting down watching it all the way from front to back. And I thought it was fine. I thought it was totally fine.
Well, I'm glad that... my blind spot forced you to do a little homework and finish your assignment.
Yeah.
This, like I said, this was a blind spot for me. I'm not exactly sure why it is I skipped it when it came out in 1983, but I know over the years I've kind of resisted it because I had the impression it was not going to be a pleasant experience to watch the movie. And whenever you know that something is going to be tough or not so much challenging, but maybe uncomfortable, it doesn't really seem conducive to say, well, let me pop that in just for a couple of hours to enjoy some time watching a movie, and that's what I've managed to do for 40 years is avoid watching this movie. But I did want to see it. I am a fan of Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro. I'd heard good things about the movie, despite the fact that it's kind of uncomfortable to watch. And I thought, well, this will be a chance to, you know, finally check something off and see if I was wrong, see if it was worthy and deserving of my attention after all, and if I should shame myself for 40 years of neglect. My general impression is that it's a good film, but not one that I ever want to see again. You know, I don't know if that's a fair way of talking about it, but that's kind of the way I feel about it now, because it is uncomfortable to watch a lot. We're watching somebody who is, you know, basically a disturbed person interacting in a world with people who are likely to not be friendly toward him and not necessarily be sympathetic, although I thought Jerry Langford and his team bent over backwards to be accommodating and polite in the course of the film. Did you think that their response to Rupert Pumpkin was appropriate, inappropriate, reasonable? Did you think it was civil, at least? Todd, you sound amused by the question.
Well, it's one of those things where you watch this and you go, well, how would I respond, I guess? You know, and am I more likely to be the jerk that's trying to weasel his way in, or am I, you know, the other people? I guess I was getting a little amused with the comment you made about, you know, being glad you watched it, but you don't know that you would watch it again because it's an uncomfortable watch. And I can see that to a degree, but at the same time, I think as I was thinking about it after watching this, I was like, you know, I think I might consider this one of the most rewatchable Scorsese films, because I think I do often have to kind of build myself up to watch other Scorsese movies because they are heavy and there's, you know, a big kind of emotional investment that you make in entering some of those films. And with this one, I think that still holds true, but I also think there is a little bit of a lightness to this one that you don't see in all Scorsese films, because even as uncomfortable as Rupert Pumpkin can be as a character, there's still something that's kind of, I don't know, jovial and a little bit just lighter. I mean, he just wants everybody to like him. And even though he does that in an uncomfortable way, it's not quite the same as Joe Pesci telling you, what, you think I'm a clown? You know, it's
yeah,
different.
Well, I think that's a very good point. Pupkin is never malevolent in the way he's going about doing this. It's even when he's threatening, he's not really coming across as somebody who is malicious, but rather somebody who is simply deluded into, you know, what can I get from taking the action that I'm taking in this story?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I in a lot of ways, you know, even though, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that his reactions are unwarranted, but I actually find Jerry Lewis to be the more sinister character at times in this.
Well, we'll talk about Jerry in just a minute. Nick, did you find Rupert Pumpkin somebody that you could sympathize with?
At times, yes, but for the most part, no. It's one of those performances where it's hard to put into words, because it's a good performance, and you know it's a good performance because of how affecting it can be, and how there's times where he's on the screen and I can't look at the screen because I can't watch what's happening. I'm so uncomfortable. I can't see this. The guy just can't take a hint. It's very similar to like Adam Sandler in Uncut Gems. Very similar performance, is very much a guy just like trying to push through and trying to get there. And you see the performance and you see the writing and it's all well and good, but there's just something about it where I can't look at him. I can't look at him when he's going through this. There's just such an uncomfortability with it that I want to root for the guy, but I also want to root for him to like, hey, just let it click and move on. Like, please accept what's happening and continue to go. But not having that acceptance, there's also, in a weird way, a bit of an admiration, because here's a guy that keeps pushing and pushing to get what he really wants. And good on him for putting forth that effort. But at the same time, it's like, to what end?
Yeah.
please just stop now.
He's not directing it in the right place. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. And I get totally what you're saying there, Nick. I mean, you know, it is a challenge when you're watching a movie and the central characters make you uncomfortable. You know, Uncut Gems is a great example. Yeah, and I think Adam Sandler does a great job in that movie. And as uncomfortable as he makes me, I am captivated by it. When you were describing your experience, it made me think about how I react to the series The Office. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people love The Office. I just can't deal with The Office because these characters, I sit there and they make me so uncomfortable. I go, please tell me there's not really people like this in the world. You know, they just don't get the way to exist in polite society, you know, and it washes out the comedy for me. I just can't deal with it. So I can get where people would respond the same way to something like this.
Yeah, I'm the exact same way when it comes to The Office. Like, the wife is a huge fan. She's trying to make me watch episodes, and I'm like, please don't do this. Like, I don't want to do this.
I'm confused. Are you guys talking about the American Office or the British Office? Because I think what you're saying is very true of the British one.
Oh, maybe I haven't gone far enough in the American Office, but, you know, the ones that I've seen, I mean, the Steve Carell character, which is the Ricky Gervais character, I just go, oh my gosh, please tell me there's nobody that really is like this.
I have heard that the tone of the two different versions is very different once the shows get started, and that you know, the American version of The Office is more tolerable because the characters become more sympathetic. And that was the question I was going to ask Matthew. Have you ever encountered somebody that was so clueless that you were sympathetic about with them in their cluelessness?
So as a person who spent 20 odd years working in middle management for a large corporation, primarily focused on sales, I've known a million Michael Scotts and a million Pumpkins. And no, I don't feel sympathy for. I feel sympathy for the Michael Scotts of the world, who are kind of like bumbling, well-intentioned idiots. But I was going to chime in and say that I sort of disagree about what you guys were saying about Rupert Pupkin, because I found him to be sinister from the get-go.
Really?
He's a sociopath.
I was just going to say,
I recognize that like right away, and I get that like he's doing it with a smile on his face, but there's no moment in this film where I was like, oh, this guy's sympathetic. Most of the film I was like, oh, that guy seems like he's really layering on the charm. I wonder if he's going to kill anyone by the end. like,
can you really smile at your stalker and feel like, oh, you're an okay person, I just don't like you?
Yeah, like, and to be fair, at the beginning of the film, the first time they really like meet in the film is the first time they meet ever, and I get Jerry Lewis's character's reaction in that moment, just being like, I need to get rid of this guy. I'm not really putting any stock in how dangerous he might actually be. But, like, I recognized it from the start, is all I'm saying. Because I've known lots of people like this, and they're terrible and dangerous. And I'm not saying that I've met, like, murderers and kidnappers, but, like, I've met people who will just do whatever it takes to get whatever they want. And it is, at the very least, exhausting and draining and terrible. So yeah, I didn't find him sympathetic at all.
I've had that experience of sitting in an audience when there's a Q&A session and some celebrity is talking, and a person gets up and either asks a question or wants to make a personal statement or share something about what's going on in their world, and everybody in the audience is just looking away and wishing that this person would stop talking. And that's kind of the way I felt this whole movie.
Yeah, Rupert Pupkin is very definitely more of a comment than a question kind of guy, for sure.
Well, Martin Scorsese has said that he thought Robert De Niro gave his best performance in one of his movies in this film. Would any of you agree? And if not, why? And if so, why?
I personally would disagree. only because, and maybe this is just me, but in the beginning of the film, when he's in the cab talking to Jerry, and his character's like, yeah, you know, I'm 34, or like, you know, you start at the bottom working way up, he's like, but I'm 34, and when he said that, I'm like, you don't look 34 to me. Like, I'm 34, and I don't know
anybody else.
Was
Robert De Niro ever 34?
Yeah. Yeah, you know what I mean? And as he's going, I'm like, okay, I can kind of see there's little moments, there's fleeting moments of a really great performance there, like, you know, kind of when he's with the cassette tape player by himself and the way he kind of reacts and calls back and forth to his mom and everything with this, like, squandered innocence, like, kind of just a little bit of anger there. But I don't know. I didn't see, like, a fully realized, in my mind, like, character of, like, who this person was. It kind of just felt like De Niro being just very forthcoming, like, just, I don't know, it didn't feel like his best in my mind. It was close and there's some great moments there, but it just didn't feel like a fully realized character to me.
I think it's a very good performance. Again, I don't know that I'd go as far as to say it's his best in a Scorsese film, but there's a lot of things that I really enjoy about it. You know, you were referencing the scenes there where he's like, you know, doing the thing on the tape and, you know, rehearsing in his room and his mother's shouting at him. I love the whole bit with, you know, where he's got these huge cutouts of Jerry Lewis and other, you know, celebrities. And so he can sit there and interact with them like he's on the talk show. It looks like something like Kramer would do on Seinfeld. You know, in fact, is there
I think there was an episode.
Because there's like a Merv Griffin thing or something. Memories popping out here. I don't know. I fear a little bit saying that I can relate with the character at some points, because this isn't necessarily the kind of character you want to claim that you can relate with. But I mean, who of us hasn't, you know, had those, you know, ambitions to, you know, be something, and you're, you know, a teenager sitting in your room and, you know, pretending you're a, you know, you grab a tennis racket and you're staring in the mirror playing along with your Bon Jovi records or whatever. You know, I mean, we've all done that kind of thing. I think it's intriguing that here we have a 34-year-old man that hasn't advanced beyond that, even to the point where his mother is still there shouting at him from a few rooms away.
Yeah, I think the thing that is really good about the performance is the consistency of the character. He is always the way he is. In this movie, he's never somebody who isn't on, who isn't pushing at any given time, who isn't trying to put forward his best self, even when he is clearly delusional about some things. The scene that obviously for me, and I think other people will find most uncomfortable, is when he and his near girlfriend show up at Jerry's house to spend the weekend uninvited, and it's a moment where you just go, oh my gosh, how horrifying would this be, how embarrassing it is for the girl, and how scary it would be for the household help and Jerry. And De Niro doesn't blink in that scene. It's all completely, we're friends, we're pals, we're doing this, we're working through this, it's all going on. And I just found that there's a lot of consistency in that character, and that's what makes the performance great for me. I'm not sure how much variety there is in emotion or expression there is, but I think that one of the things that makes this character interesting is like we said, the focus that he has. He is single-minded in his approach to what he is trying to get, and that's the thing that makes the character, I think, makes the performance work a little bit.
I mean, I think that, you know, like I said before, you're right, it's very consistent, and I think that's because the character is a sociopath, so I think he is trying to put his best foot forward, like his best self forward most of the movie, all of the movie, but he doesn't understand how to do that in the world. So I think it's actually a really compelling, I would say that I didn't dislike the movie, I didn't love the movie, but I would say that it is a very compelling performance. I would also agree, I don't know that I would call it one of his best, but I will say that, like, if you were a person who was familiar with Robert De Niro in like 1981 and then saw this in 1982, it might have been a bit of a revelation to see, you know, the guy who was previously Jake LaMotta and Vito Corleone and Travis Bickle being such a different kind of character. I bet that was a big deal for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good point and another reason why that performance might be seen by some, especially Scorsese, as being his best. I'm with you other guys. I think that he's been better in other films, but this is like strangely one of the big failures in Scorsese's career. This was a movie that came after he'd had quite a bit of success with other films, movies that made money, that he'd spent a good amount of money on. This movie basically tanked. It was in theaters for 2 weeks and then disappeared. So it's kind of a strange example of a movie that didn't work, and the director had his doubts about the movie afterwards, but he didn't have any doubt about the performance of his lead actor. I thought that was kind of an odd way of relating to the movie for him. Jerry Lewis apparently was surprised at some of the critical praise that he received for the movie. He kind of disregarded the praise, saying he was just basically playing himself. What did you think of his performance?
Yeah, I got to agree with him. I looked at it, and I'm like, yeah, it's Jerry Lewis. I mean, all they did was just change the last name to Langford, and then that was kind of it.
It's interesting because, first of all, I know Jerry Lewis, when it comes to his on-screen persona, is, you know, an acquired taste. Not everybody cares for Jerry Lewis when it comes to, like, the Martin and Lewis stuff and the stuff he did after that and all that. I enjoy his early films. But I've always been kind of put off by his actual persona. You know, I like the clown, but Jerry Lewis, the actual Jerry Lewis, I've always been like, this guy thinks a lot of himself, you know, and I always had a hard time, even as a kid, like watching the telethon thing. You know, I always thought it was weird when you would see this guy, you know, on this glitzy stage in Las Vegas dressed in a tuxedo and with, you know, gaudy jewelry and a cigarette dangling from his fingers and all that, standing there asking me for money. You know, I'm like, really, dude? I mean, come on, you know, you can pay for this whole thing. It always struck me as an odd kind of, I don't know, dynamic between his on-screen persona and the actual guy. And I think it's weird watching this film and seeing him play that kind of, I don't know, off-putting character that he presented himself as in real life. You know, it's, and I think it's really interesting too, just to see the way that they create these scenes where we see the talk show and all that stuff, and just the self-congratulatory and disingenuous nature of these talk shows from the 70s, where, you know, you just get a bunch of celebrities get on stage together and tell each other how great they all think they are. I mean, it you know, I was watching this again and going, oh my goodness, those Sammy Maudlin sketches from old SCTV are spot on about how these celebrities just go on there and congratulate each other and think we all think it's great, you know? So, I don't know. That's what I was saying earlier, where I find the Jerry Langford character just to be, you know, very unpleasant in all this. But at the same time, I think that Jerry Lewis does a great job of pulling it off. Maybe it is just him playing himself. Maybe he doesn't realize that he comes off as that terrible, but I like the way that he does it here.
Well, I thought
the way that he,
go ahead.
Sorry. I like the way that he portrays it. I think that, I'm not familiar enough with Jerry Lewis's full body of work to know him for anything other than basically, and now this, and then the more silly stuff he's sort of widely known for. But I would say that I would say that it's a really interesting and compelling performance, knowing what I know about him, like what a very gay type in a way that I really admire. And I think it's a really interesting choice to cast someone who's so beloved for being so silly to be a character who's ultimately so cynical and defensive And I think it's a brilliant choice of casting. And even if he's only playing, you know, quote himself, I think you find some really interesting and authentic, like, emotional responses in the films he's in. So I think all the praise he garnered was totally worth it, like, totally deserved. Personally, I thought he was great.
Well, I do think that he does kind of an impersonation at the beginning of the film when he is playing the role of the talk show host. I think he does a great Johnny Carson. He's got the moves down, coming out from behind the curtain, acknowledging the band, kind of relating to Ed, his sidekick there, introducing people. He stole several kinds of gestures and movements from Johnny Carson right there. And I know Carson apparently was offered the role and turned it down, so they just said, well, let's have somebody counterfeit him. And I thought they did a good job at that. Now, the stuff that occurs later in the film, I do see sometimes when he's actually pretty restrained, for example, in that sequence at the house, at the, you know, the country house for the weekend, because again, one of those situations, how would I react in this circumstance? I would certainly be a lot more angry, frustrated, probably acting out and reactive to this person showing up at my house than the Jerry Langford character was. But maybe he's made this measured judgment that I'm dealing with somebody who is nuts and I have to maintain some level of calmness in the face of this insanity. I don't know that it helped him in the long run, at least not in this story.
He should have just called the cops. He just stands there and stares at him and seethes. And, you know, it's like either he thinks he's really tough or he, like, is standing there with the, you know, I know people type of a stance, you know, which, I mean, Jerry Lewis probably did know people, you know, but I don't know. I would have called the cops.
Yeah.
I wonder too that, look, but the house he shows up at is meant to be like out of the city, so he's probably just. My read was that he was like, I need to like not overreact and to not set this guy off because we could call the cops, but they're going to take a few minutes to get here, and in the meantime, this guy could go nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so far we've talked about Rupert Pumpkin quite a bit, and Pumpkin is. Clearly a sociopath and has all kinds of mental issues. Strangely, though, he's not the one who has the biggest mental issues in this movie.
No, he's not.
So that's where we're going to go next. Todd, you want to get started on that?
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, for all the, you know, squirminess that Rupert Pupkin may cause in this movie, yeah, I mean, Sandra Bernhard's character is far more disturbing, and I'm sure you know, it's probably aided by the fact that I have always found Sandra Bernhard to be one of the most annoying public figures in the world. I did not care for her in anything, really. I mean, she's just one of those people that would always pop up at various things during the 80s, and I was just like, not her again. But she makes it work in this because I think her performance is really good, and I do think it's the most disturbing aspect of the whole film. I mean, you know, the things that, you know, Rupert Pumpkin only kind of hints at and goes for, she is actively trying to make things happen and is the one that if you gave it just a few more minutes, there would be disaster. So, yeah, she's definitely the most disturbing aspect of the film for me.
So you won't be surprised at all to know that most of her performance was improvised.
Oh, my goodness.
Seems to be reflective of her personality, so to speak. Yeah, that sequence when they have him tied up with the tape and she's engaged in whatever the hell is that she thinks she's engaged in, there's a good moment of discomfort for everybody as well. Holy criminy.
It's aside from the point, but I do love the detail of just how much tape they used to have to tie it up.
It's like they use masking tape instead of duct tape. And, you know, I'm not sure if that was supposed to be something that Pupkin consciously thought of because well, this will be easier to take off and less uncomfortable, or whether he's just so clueless as he picked up the first thing that was available and he's so imbecilic about this whole thing that he's doing. At one point, the FBI guys suggest, oh, we must be brilliant because of the way he's handling all this. And we're going, I'm not sure that that's the way to go about looking at this.
I love that aspect of things, though, that we've seen, you know, Rupert kind of bumble his way through this whole movie. And then when, you know, he really is, you know, kind of executing this plan and it becomes more serious, all these other people who, you know, you would think would just write him off as a wacko all think he's a genius, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that the whole kidnapping plot just seems like it was, they didn't know. Pupkin and Marcia don't really understand what it is they're doing. They're just obsessive people who are acting on impulse and didn't really have much of a plan, although, you know, calling from the payphone I guess is the right way to go. Won't be doing that
What's
anymore, will you? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, remember payphones? Pepperidge Farm remembers.
I was out for a walk a couple of years ago, and there was actually a payphone on the street, and I went, holy criminy, I wondered if it worked. It didn't. It was just sitting there.
It was art. It's no longer functional. It's just there as art.
Now it's just public art. There you are. I know.
You split your time between Austin and California, right? So I assume it was a movie prop that was just left over.
Yeah, well, it was in Southern California, so maybe that was it. You know, maybe they just had it out there and left it, and nobody cleaned up after they did their commercial shoot. That's possible.
Yeah. I just like to chime in and say that, like, I actually didn't find Sandra Bernhardt's character to be worse than De Niro's. I think that they just wanted, like, Marcia just wanted Jerry, and, you know, Rupert wanted to be famous and use Jerry to get there. So I don't think that she was worse. I think she was more direct and more, she was getting what she wanted in those scenes, I guess, and so was Rupert. So I think they're sort of equally sociopathic. And I also find Sandra Bernhardt's whole shtick to be a little on the annoying side, but I think it really worked in this movie, personally. Yeah.
It's all in the casting. That's why they've decided to give a casting award with the Academy Awards, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Which is great. They should do title sequences and stunts next.
Yes, the stunt guys have been asking for this for three decades, and they've still been bypassed here for something that probably is deserving. I'm not trying to diminish the casting process, because I know that that is in fact a critical component of making a film work. But Jiminy Crickets, you know, let's not ignore the fact that we live in a world where most movies that come out nowadays are dependent on the stunts and the action sequences that are going on. We've got so much of that, and skipping it over seems like it's just an oversight. Another misstep by the Academy in trying to broaden appeal to a wider audience. I think they missed an opportunity here. But that's another issue. You know?
I was going to say,
okay, segue that into the stunts on this film, right?
Yeah. Well, yes. Well, I think it's interesting because it is kind of a stunt. When Jerry Lewis does that walk down the street, that was another one of those things that was largely dependent on him being who he is. One of the reasons that he had them use his own name rather than a name that they had picked out was so that people on the street, when they called out, they could use those sequences. There are only two people in that scene who are actors, and that's the cab driver and the woman who makes the comment, you know, I hope you get cancer.
That's a great moment.
Which apparently is based on something that actually happened to him.
Oh my god.
You know, there's no satisfying some fans, you know, you stop, you sign an autograph for somebody, and then they want more from you. And when we talk about Jerry Langford being an unpleasant character, you also have to put it in the context that he is a public figure that is often, you know, treated badly, despite the fact that he is also beloved by people. And, you know, that I think that's a good illustration of it. And Pupkin and Marcia are both examples of the extreme end of that stick, but you're still getting beat with it one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Now, I see this film listed as a comedy. Did anybody think it was particularly funny?
I found it funnier watching it this time than when I did my first time watching it. And it's not so much funny. There's like a couple line deliveries that are funny. There's placements of things. There's just little quirks here and there that make it funny. But I don't think overall it's so much a comedy as it's a drama with some comedic moments in there. Like even when they finally show his stand-up bit, overall funny. Yeah, there was definitely some funny parts. But obviously the whole film has to be funny and not just like little moments here and there.
I mean, I think I'm on board with what Nick's saying, but I think it's also fair to call it a dark comedy. I think for me, some of the funnier moments kind of come out of where it, I don't know, kind of pokes fun at the ridiculousness of celebrity and you know, kind of the pedestal that we put them on and some of the odd things that we see happen in the context of, you know, like in this case, a late night talk show. I mean, like some of the funnier moments for me are when you have like some of the fantasy scenes that Rupert Pupkin has where he's imagining himself as this celebrity who is, you know, a regular guest on Jerry Langford's show. And, you know, they do this wedding on the air and, you know, Dr. Joyce Brothers is one of the bridesmaids and Victor Borga is playing the piano. You know, these people that would actually show up on these talk shows back in the 70s and 80s. And I was like, does Dr. Joyce Brothers even realize that they're poking fun at her in this for always showing up on these shows? I don't know. I found those moments to be pretty funny.
Well, you know,
I would agree with all of that. But like, it's definitely a comedy. It's just dark as hell. But, you know, it's
well, that whole
satirizing America's love of celebrity and what people will do to be famous and, I wouldn't say that it's – I would say it's comedy in the same way that – just to bring it back to an earlier comparison, the same way the British Office is. It's funny in that way where you're kind of like baring your teeth and wincing through it because it's very awkward and cringy. But it is funny. It is comedy to
me.
Well,
in a way, we're being invited to laugh at somebody's mental illness, you know.
Yeah.
Rupert Pupkin has this set in his basement with the cutouts there, and he goes through this process like he's doing the show – and that's kind of funny if you don't mind laughing at somebody who is clearly mentally disturbed acting out on their fantasy.
And today he'd be filming it and posting it on YouTube.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you.
He'd be live streaming it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he'd probably become a YouTube celebrity and, you know, be recruited to act in movies.
Which is ads for Doritos and
exactly all that kind of stuff. Well, like I said, the tone of the film is interesting because it is listed in some places as a comedy, but it's definitely a dark comedy at best. And for the most part, I think it's a tragedy. One of the tragedies is the end because the result is that somebody who has committed a horrendous criminal act. At least in the, you know, it's not quite clear if we're living in a fantasy at the end or if that's a reality about what happens. I could easily believe that somebody convicted this crime serves only 2.5 years. That's the way the criminal justice system seems to work nowadays. And it's not hard to believe that they would then become a successful celebrity with book sales and even their own talk show. I think that's kind of forecasting in 1983, some of the things that have happened over the years, we just talked about, like the YouTube insanity that sometimes happens, people becoming famous for being awful people and people following awfulness that goes on here. Can you think of some other films that kind of have this same theme where, you know, it's about both celebrity, it's about media, and it's about people being successful despite the fact that they're doing something awful. The film that came to my mind immediately was Network.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was saying in an interesting way, I think that this film visits some of the same themes that Scorsese's later film, The Wolf of Wall Street, does, in that, like, that's a movie that was... So, there's a lot of people who will say that movie glorifies Jordan Belfort, and I usually respond by saying, oh, so you didn't watch the last hour of the movie? The other thing is that, like, it does sort of, like, make you feel sympathy, and you kind of want to, like, root for him, and then at the end, when he gets, like, a slap on the wrist, and you're sort of supposed to realize, like, oh, like, I was sympathizing with the bad guy. I should probably investigate that a little bit. And I feel like this film is making some of the same points in that, like, he did a bunch of terrible stuff and he's being rewarded for it. And I totally took the end to be, you're right. It's not really clear whether it's fantasy or reality, but I am perfectly happy to accept it either way.
Like, oh, that's
if it's
a good
fantasy,
point.
Then it's, mm-hmm. you know, like, if it's fantasy, then he's in his cell, like, you know, trying to get through the day. And if it's reality, it's also just totally believable that he would get out and people would reward him for doing this thing. Because the one thing we didn't really talk about it, Todd, I think you touched on it, but, like, when he finally gets up and does his comedy set, like, it's not bad.
No,
like, it's not great. Don't be wrong. It's not great. It's perfectly safe 70s, you know, late 70s TV comedy, all jokes I've heard before, but, like, it's not bad. And he's exactly the kind of person who would probably succeed, you know, based on that kind of thing. So I think the ending is one of the stronger things about the movie is the way it ends, because it's really trying to say something about, you know, America and America's sort of obsession with celebrity and fame in a way that I appreciate.
I had always just accepted the end as being, you know, what actually happens. Not until you said it did I even think, oh, this could totally still be a fantasy, because we have several fantasy sequences throughout the film. So it could slip back into fantasy for that. But I always just took it as this is the way that it actually happened. And going back to the stand-up routine, too. Yeah, I mean... I'd seen the film before, but as I was rewatching it a few days ago, it was kind of, I hadn't remembered that when he finally gets to do his act, that it's not that bad. And I admire the fact that De Niro actually does it. He does it in one take, you know, and it's not edited. It's just as it would be if it was, you know, a new comedian showing up there on The Tonight Show, wondering if Johnny's going to invite them to come over and sit down or not. You know, it's a solid sequence.
Well, I thought it was interesting that the notes that Rupert's given by the assistant about his tape are really reflected pretty well in this. You know, he's got good timing while he's telling his jokes. The jokes are okay, but, you know, he just needs some polish to become better. So it implied to me that somebody actually looked at or listened to his tape and bothered to give him some feedback on this. So I don't see them as being, you know, necessarily just trying to give him the complete brush off, but they're, you know, going through the process. But boy, you know, you give somebody an inch and they take a mile, and that's what we get going here. You know, there's just a lot of when you reward somebody for bad behavior, it encourages bad behavior, and that's kind of the way the world is.
I want to take the opportunity to say that I like Shelley Hack's performance in this as the, you know, the secretary who's dealing with him in the room there. You know, he gives her the tape, and then she's the one that has to kind of come back and try and, you know, give him some information, but also try to get him out and all that. You know, it's I mean, you feel her level of being uncomfortable in that whole thing. And, you know, anybody that's worked in customer service and stuff, you had to deal with those situations where you're just trying to go, all right, well, I'm giving you the information I can give you, and now move on, and people won't move on. And, you know, so I thought she is, I mean, just as, you know, an important, a component of that sequence as De Niro is.
I think that's a good point. And I don't know that she was ever thought of as a great actress, but I thought she was good in this particular part.
Yeah. She's one of Charlie's Angels, though. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't think she was ever thought of as a good actress, but she was perfectly good in this part. Can anybody think of other films where the goal is to deliberately make the audience feel uncomfortable while watching it that you would say are comparable to this film?
Well, I mean, the one that always comes up nowadays with this, of course, is Joker. Because yeah, a lot of people say that this is, you know, a lot of what they did in Joker.
It's a companion piece, basically.
Yeah, was drawn right from this film. And after watching this again, I was like, I kind of want to revisit Joker again and see, you know, what, especially with the, you know, a second one coming out later this year. I was kind of like, okay, yeah, I kind of want to, you know, see these two in close succession just to see where they were pulling from King of Comedy.
Well, the only places in Joker they aren't pulling from King of Comedy is when they're pulling from Taxi Driver. So,
that's true.
I know I'm in the minority because I honestly really hated Joker. Like I really reacted poorly, really did not connect with that film at all. But now having finally sat down and watched this movie like front to back, all in one setting, like yeah, they just remade this movie and but less good. Yeah.
And now they're doing a sequel, and they're going to copy Sandra Bernhardt's character.
Oh, yeah, that'd be wild.
Well, maybe that's what Lady Gaga is going to be doing in the sequel here.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, well, at least the sequel will be a musical, so that'll be at least interesting.
Well, any other thoughts about the movie before we kind of close out this part of the discussion?
I really like the visual style of everything. It wasn't too like dark and gritty. It wasn't too over the top with the colors and like fantasy elements. I think they did a really good job of having enough difference there, but not at the same time to kind of keep that through line of what is real versus what isn't real. And I think overall, like it just looked really good.
Yeah, I like the sequences where they basically videotape the show that's going on, and then they put it into the film, you know, as if it was television, and it looks different. And I think that that's a reasonable directorial choice that works for the film. Like I said, I think that some of the sequences go on a long time for the purpose of making us feel more and more uncomfortable, and so I kind of like that aspect of it. Like I said, I admire a lot of what's going on in this movie. I think that people who made the movie did a good job putting together what they're doing. I'm just not sure that it's something that I needed.
I want to say, too, I like Scorsese's cameo in this.
Yes.
A good part for him making him the director of the TV show. And I love that, you know, like Tony Randall's there saying, really? I got to say this joke? This is an awful joke. He's like, no, that's a funny joke. Right, Tony.
Well, the director knows best.
I also like Scorsese's mother's cameo as Rupert Pupkin's mother. Well, Cameron, yeah. Voice only.
The origin of the Big Bang Theory character, I like to think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we don't do Lamb scores on a regular basis anymore, and I wasn't going to have you guys give Lamb scores, but would you recommend this movie to people?
Yes, I recommend this.
Okay.
I also would. Like, it's a great example of an earlier, maybe different Robert De Niro performance that most people probably associate his early career with. And it's obviously been very influential as well. So I think it's definitely, I'm always on team see it for yourself. So yes, I'm going to recommend it full stop.
I would to 90% of people. There's some people that come to me and like, hey, should I watch this movie? I'd be like, maybe not for you, but for most people I would.
Yeah, and I think I have the same attitude. I would recommend this, but I would always give people a little bit of cautionary note when I recommend it. Say it's a well-made movie. It's got some important themes in it, but I don't think you're going to like yourself or the movie very well afterwards. Not because it's not good, but because it is, well, like I said, tough to
challenging.
Yeah, challenging. Definitely challenging. Well, thank you, guys.
We can say that about a number of Scorsese films,
yes,
though, can't we?
Yes. Well, that may come up in a little bit, because when we get to our exit question, some of those issues are going to be discussed. We're going to take a break now for a fellow Lamb Podcasting Network show, and we'll be back with a game and our exit question.
I was having serious problems in the bedroom, and in the car, and on the bus. But I couldn't help but think there had to be something out there for people suffering just like me.
Podcast dysfunction affects 6 out of 7 cinema geeks out there, but there is help. The Simplistic Reviews Podcast.
Symptoms of the Simplistic Reviews Podcast may include loss of sleep, loss of hair, longer erections, less family get-together, bleeding of eyes, ears, and anus, divorce, hated by town folk, rash, the ability to drink alcohol and podcast at the same time, mansplaining, weight gain, weight loss, people with severe podcasting games, depression, happiness, growth of boobs and hair on chest, constant peeing, watery eyes, and 3 additional inches on your penis, and if you don't have a penis, you will now.
Thanks to the Simplistic Reviews Podcast, I'm no longer bored in the bedroom. Plus, I have a perpetual erection. Although I think I'm going blind.
The Simplistic Reviews Podcast. A small price to pay for entertainment.
We're back and it's time for our game for the week. And this week it's Comedy Lamberty. Basically, we're going to be playing the Jeopardy version of the game that has been notoriously famous here on the Lam. But this week, we don't have Jay. We're not going to take a lot of time to do it. We're going to go through it very quickly. Because the answers, I don't think, are that complicated. I should say the questions are not that complicated, because you answer in the form of a question. So we've got 2 rounds that we can do. Each round has 5 categories. You score 100 points, 200 points, 300 points, 400 points, or 500 points, depending upon the question that's being asked. I'm not going to worry too much about who goes first. I'm going to have Matt go first. And then, of course, after that, it just depends on your name is your buzzer. So here are the categories. Category number 1, those aren't pillows. Category number 2, does Barry Manilow know that you raid his wardrobe? Category number 3, my best sport is video hockey. Category number 4, call Starkist. And category number 5, there's a new sheriff in town. I think you'll be able to figure out what all of those categories mean when you hear what some of the answers are. So, Matt, we're going to start with you. Which category do you want to go for, and do you want to go for 100, 200, 300, 400, or 500?
Let's start with those aren't pillows for 100.
Those aren't pillows for 100. You're going to get the description of a film. You have to tell me what the film is in the form of a question. Laid-back commitment phobe babysits his brother's rebellious teenage daughter and her cute younger brother and sister. Anybody Matthew. Can answer, by the way. Matthew.
Is that Uncle Buck?
It is Uncle Buck for 100 points.
Yeah, what is Uncle Buck? Sorry.
See, and I already screwed it up. There you go. Thank you. You got it. You corrected yourself. Yeah. I appreciate it. What category is next? Yeah. Where do you want to go next?
Let's stay there for 200.
All right. A Chicago man and his family go camping with his obnoxious brother-in-law.
Todd. What is The Great Outdoors?
Todd gets 200 points for that one. Todd, where are we going next?
Let's stay with that category.
A star pilot for hire and his trusty sidekick must come to the rescue of a princess and save planet Druidia from the clutches
Nick,
of an evil.
Todd.
I heard Nick's name.
What is Spaceballs?
Spaceballs is correct. You got 300 there.
Let's
where
keep
are we going? Same category? A Chicago advertising man must struggle to travel home from New York for Thanksgiving. Todd.
Matthew.
What is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
400 points for Todd. And are we going to finish that category, Todd?
Yeah, might as well.
A fired cop and his useless lawyer and a useless lawyer sign up as security guards and find that they've joined a corrupt union.
Todd. Is it Armed and Dangerous?
It is Armed and Dangerous. As you could probably tell, those were all films featuring John Candy.
I answered, is it Armed and Dangerous? I just said, what is Armed and Dangerous? But still.
Is it? It's still a question.
It's still a question.
Yes, I think the inflection there works for that. So, Todd, where are we going next?
Let's just go to Barry Manilow.
Does Barry Manilow know that you raid his wardrobe? All right. Which category? How many points?
What? 100. Let's do 100.
100. A girl's birthday is anything but special as her family forgets about it and she suffers from every embarrassment possible.
Todd.
Todd.
What is 16 candles?
It is 16 candles. And You continue to control the board.
Keep going with this one.
Two high school nerds use a computer program to literally create the perfect
Todd.
Todd.
What is weird Nick. Science?
Weird science is correct.
Same category.
A popular high school student admired by his peers decides to take a day off from school and goes to extreme lengths
Todd.
To pull it off.
Matthew.
I heard Nick's answer first. Nick?
What is Ferris Bueller's day off?
There's 300 points for Nick.
Keep it going. Same category, 400.
A family's cross-country drive to a theme park proves to be much more
Nick.
Arduous to Nick.
What is National Lampoon's family vacation?
That is correct. That's 400 points for you.
Let's finish it out.
A family wins a vacation across Europe where the usual havoc ensues. Todd.
What is National Lampoon's European vacation?
There you go. See, I told you these questions are easy. Nobody is missing any of these. It's just a question
oink, oink.
Of who gets
we'll
in first.
Pissed.
Yes, like Mike. Todd, you control the board.
That was the end of that one, right?
Yes, it was.
Let's just keep going in order. Video hockey.
All right, my best sport is video hockey. A detective must adopt a rambunctious dog in order to help him find a killer.
Nick.
Todd.
Nick.
What is Turner and Hooch?
Turner and Hooch is the correct answer. You control the board.
Same category, 200.
The equally straight-laced and by-the-book nephew of Joe Friday must work with his more laid-back
Todd.
Partner, Todd.
What is Dragnet?
Dragnet is correct, so that's 200 more points for Todd.
Same category.
An overstressed suburbanite and his neighbors are convinced that the new family on the
Todd.
Block... Todd.
The Burbs.
The Burbs. Todd
Which,
is
What
raking
is the Burbs?
Up, what is Which the Burbs? Thank you
celebrated
for...
Celebrated its 35th anniversary this week, I think I saw.
Well, there you go. Gives you a reason to watch it again because you got points watching it from...
Why wouldn't
questions.
You watch it? It's
yes.
Joe Dante. Come on.
All right.
Same category.
After wishing, a teenage boy wakes up the next morning to find himself mysteriously in the body
Nick,
of an adult.
Todd.
Nick, I heard you.
What is big?
That's correct. Matt, you got to get in there a little bit more.
I keep bringing in and you keep calling Nick's name.
The Skype lag.
It could be.
It's, yeah.
A young couple struggles to repair a hopelessly dilapidated house.
Todd.
Todd.
What is the money pit?
That is the correct answer. And you have probably figured out the category?
Tom Hanks movies.
That's it.
Yeah.
Call Starkist. I assume we're just going through the
yeah,
list. There
let's
you
do
go.
It.
All right. Todd?
100, yeah.
For 100. A mild-mannered morgue attendant and his new coworker run a prostitution ring out of the morgue.
Todd.
Todd.
Oh, wait, I had it. What is night shift?
There's 100 points for Todd. Four mental patients on a field trip to New York City must save their caring chaperone who ends up being
Todd.
Taken to... Todd?
What is the dream team?
That is correct.
Same category.
The spirits of a deceased couple are harassed by an unbearable family that has moved into their
Matthew.
Home. Matthew!
That's Beetlejuice. What is Beetlejuice?
It is Beetlejuice, and you get 300 points. There we are.
It's showtime.
Excellent. Finally.
Are we sticking with the same category?
Yeah, let's keep going.
After he's suddenly laid off, a husband switches roles with his wife. She returns to work the workplace.
Todd.
And he becomes, Todd.
What is Mr. Mom?
Mr. Mom. That's 400 more points for Todd.
Finish the category.
When a Japanese car company buys an American plant, the American liaison...
Matthew.
Matthew.
That's gung-ho. What is gung-ho?
500 points for Matthew.
We did a forgotten
those
film cast on that one a long time ago.
And you I recognize the
those
category.
Those are all Michael Keaton movies.
Michael Keaton movies. All right. There's a new sheriff in town. We go in 100. We're just going to go straight down. That's easiest to do.
Yeah. Let's just keep doing the
All right. An extremely pampered African prince travels to Queens, New York and goes undercover.
Todd.
Todd.
What is Coming to America?
100 points for Todd. A snobbish investor and a wily street con artist find their positions reversed as part
Matthew.
Of a... Matthew.
Trading Places. What is Trading Places?
What is Trading Places? There you are. A military weapons engineer struggles to do his job responsibly while a hapless tank commander has to live with the consequences in combat years
Todd.
Later.
Todd.
Todd.
What is best defense?
300 points for Todd.
What?
So yeah, that's the one where it's actually a Dudley Moore movie, but then they like inserted Eddie Murphy scenes and marketed it as an Eddie Murphy movie.
There you go. A hard-nosed cop reluctantly teams up with a wisecracking criminal to temporarily parole to him in order to track down a killer. Todd.
What is 48 hours?
And what is 400 more points for Todd? And a freewheeling Detroit cop pursuing a murder investigation finds himself dealing with the very different culture of Southern California. Todd.
What is Beverly Hills Cop?
500 points. And we finished off the first set of categories. I would have to do math here that is extensive. Let me just say that Todd is substantially in the lead. Not having lost any points at all.
Embarrassingly far behind everyone else.
And Nick and Matt are far
We're
behind.
We're just happy to be here.
I think Nick is in second place and Matthew's in third place, but he has scored. We'll do the totals at the end. Round two, are you guys ready?
Yeah.
All right, quickly. Our categories are Zazz, Mercy Buckets, I'm a Side Effect, Tough Guys Laugh Too, and School Days. Todd, you're in the lead. You want to go first. Which category do you like?
I'm just going to keep it easy for you, Richard, and start with Zazz for 100.
I love you guys. You guys are perfect for me because I'm not having to jump around here. Thank you very much. All right. An incompetent police detective must foil an attempt to assassinate Queen Elizabeth II.
Todd. What is The Naked Gun, from the files of Police Squad?
There's 100 points for you. After the crew becomes sick with food poisoning, an erotic ex-fighter pilot must...
Matthew.
You zoned out a little bit. Did you say an answer or say a question?
Oh, yeah. What is Airplane?
That is correct. There's 200 points for you. I'm going to keep going in the category, I assume. An American rock and roll singer is invited to a cultural festival.
Matthew. What is Top Secret?
There you are. A couple cheated by a vile businessman kidnaps his wife in retaliation, not knowing that their enemy is delighted that they did.
Matthew. What is Ruthless People?
Staging a combat here, Matt. A faulty computer causes a passenger space shuttle to head straight for the sun.
Todd. What is Airplane 2, the sequel?
Right, which was basically inspired by Zazz, but not...
Yes.
They didn't have anything to do with it. But that gave me a fifth one in the category, so I cheated. All right, then we're going to go to Mercy Buckets. After his girlfriend ditches him for a boorish ski jock, Lane decides that suicide is the only answer.
Todd. What is Better Off Dead?
100 points for Todd. I knew he'd get that one. An inspiring teenage cartoonist and his friends come to the aid of a singer trying to save her family from property.
Todd. What is One Crazy Summer?
You got it. Walter Gibson is a university freshman going through a dry spell. He takes a long road trip out to Cali. Todd.
What is The Sure Thing?
I think this category is a sure thing for Todd. Dan's trip to connect with his girlfriend includes three friendly locals, a dubious yacht skipper, corrupt police, hijacker, and pirates.
Todd. What is Hot Pursuit?
400 points for Todd. A couple of creative losers accidentally become big shots in the video music industry.
Todd. Todd. Oh, I have to get this one. What is Tape Heads?
Yes, I was going to say, this is on the Forgotten Filmcast. If you didn't get this, I was going to
mock you. Oh, I love Tape Heads. Tape Heads is fantastic.
All right, though, that completes that category, and you understand what the category was?
Yeah, that's John Cusack films.
That's it, exactly. I'm a Side Effect?
Mm-hmm.
All right. A bitter ex-husband wants his former spouse dead. A put-upon mama's boy wants his mother dead. Who will pull it off?
Oh, Todd.
Todd.
What is Throw Mama from the Train?
That's 100 points for you. A physically perfect but innocent man goes in search of his long-lost twin brother, who is short, a womanizer, and
Matthew.
A small-time... Matthew.
What is Twins?
That's 200 points for you.
Yeah, let's keep going.
Harry Valentini and Mo Dickinson are both errand boys for the mob. When they lose $250,000, they are set up to kill each other. Todd.
What is Wise Guys?
300 points for Todd.
One of the few big screen endeavors of Joe Piscopo.
Along with Dead Heat, which is not on our list, by the way.
Yeah.
A mousy romance novelist sets off for Columbia to ransom her kidnapped sister.
Todd.
Todd.
What is Romancing the Stone?
400 points for Todd. Set in the 1930s, an honest, good-hearted man is forced to turn to a life of crime to finance his neurotic mother's skyrocketing medical bills.
Oh, my. Say it again?
Set in the 1930s, an honest, good-hearted man is forced to turn to a life of crime to finance his neurotic mother's skyrocketing medical bills.
Oh, is
Todd?
I heard Nick.
Nick had it first. Yeah, Nick had it.
What is Johnny Dangerously?
500 points for Nick.
Wow.
Piscopo again.
There you go.
This is a Piscopo episode of the Lambcast.
Well, we just finished that category, and Piscopo is not necessarily the category it was.
It's the other New Jersey guy, Danny DeVito.
Danny DeVito. There you are. All right, our next category, Tough Guys Laugh Too. When the owner of a struggling used car lot is killed, it's up to his hotshot salesman to save the property.
Matthew.
Oh, jeez.
What is used cars?
That's 100 points for Matthew.
Let's keep going.
A childless couple, an ex-con, and an ex-cop decide to help themselves to another family's quintuplets.
Todd. Oh, wait. No. Wait a second. Oh, I buzzed in too soon.
Wow.
What is Raising Arizona?
That's correct.
Okay. For some reason, something made me think that was wrong. Okay. That's one of my favorite movies of all time.
All right. A bounty hunter pursues a former mafia accountant who's also being chased by a rival bounty hunter, the FBI, and Todd.
Another one of my favorites. What is Midnight Run?
300 points for Todd. After an encounter with a neckbiter, a publishing executive thinks that he's turning into a vampire.
Todd. What is Vampire's Kiss?
400 points. The rest of us are all just passengers, by the way, on this voyage at this particular point.
Seems to be, yeah.
A passionate yet unsuccessful comedian stalks and kidnaps his idol to take the spotlight for himself.
Nick.
Come on, it's obvious. You got it.
What is the King of Comedy?
There you are. 500 points for Nick for pointing
really
to today's movie.
There another one?
All right. So those were all films featuring people that are usually known as action stars in comedy roles. All right, our last category, school days. At Adams College, a group of bullied outcasts and misfits resolve to fight back. Todd.
What is Revenge of the Nerds?
100 points for Todd. A nerd gets himself in hot water with the new bully and a quiet bad boy who challenges him to a fight on the grounds of their high school at the day's end.
Todd. Awesome movie. What is 3 o'clock High?
200 points for Todd. Did either of you guys know that?
No.
All right.
Go watch 3 o'clock High right now.
Two rock and roll teens on the verge of failing their class set out on a quest to make the ultimate school history report after being presented with a time machine. Todd.
What is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure?
See, Todd wishes that I did Lamperty every time. The gym teacher has to teach remedial English if he wants tenure.
Matthew.
Todd.
What is Summer School?
400 points for Matthew. Last one.
I love that movie.
That's awesome. It's an awesome movie.
To help his discouraged son get through college, a fun-loving and obnoxious rich businessman decides to enter school as a student himself.
Todd. What is Back to School?
Back to School is correct. That's 500 points for Todd. I'm going to skip the final Jeopardy. The score is ridiculous, and we've taken up enough time here. I'm not even going to do the math. I'll post it in the notes. Let's just say nobody lost any points. There's a lot of math to do to get Todd's score because he got a lot of
my treat. Shakespeare for everyone.
Yay! Yay! All right.
Everybody, we're all going to get laid.
Excellent, excellent. Oh, I love it when people know the lines from the movies. That's very good. Very good. Well, that brings us to the end of the show, but we've got the question of the week to finish on. And I sent the question out a little bit late to everybody, but hopefully they had enough time to ponder it and think about their answers. Here's the question. Scorsese and De Niro have made 11 films together. What do you think are their best films individually? Matthew, let's start with you. What do you think Scorsese's best film is?
That doesn't have De Niro, right? Yeah, okay.
So I've been thinking about this a lot because he's made so many different kinds of movies, but I think my favorite, I'm just going to go with the recent one, the one of his that I like and have rewatched the most, and that is going to be The Wolf of Wall Street. I do love The Wolf of Wall Street a lot. I think that's probably his best recent output.
The Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah, you talked about it earlier, you know, and I gotta tell you,
yeah,
it is one of my least favorite because it feels so repetitive. I felt like I was watching the same thing over and over again for 3 hours. But you get a chance to tell us why you like it.
I don't disagree with it. I just think it's probably his most successful interrogation of like American sin to date. In a filmography full of films that are about like interrogating the dark side of like the American dream and the sins that people commit to achieve it, I think it's probably the most successful. And I also just happen to think that it's the film that DiCaprio probably should have won his Best Actor statue for. I love every second of it, and I love that it indicts the audience in a way. Like, I think it probably wasn't as successful for a lot of people. A lot of people do tend to think that it glorifies Jordan Belfort, but I think those people are sort of missing that they're the ones being indicted, not him. And I really appreciate it for that. Plus, it gave us, you know, superstar Margot Robbie, which is just a wonderful thing to have in the world. So it's my favorite of. Certainly my favorite of his recent movies, for sure.
To save time, can I jump in and say that was going to be my answer as well?
You can.
And I agree with the things that Matthew was saying. I think for me, the thing that grabs me the most about Wolf of Wall Street is the performances. I mean, I agree DiCaprio is great, but Margot Robbie and Jonah Hill steal the show for me. I find their performances to be just captivating.
Yeah, Kyle Chandler as well. I really appreciate that they cast Kyle Chandler to be Kyle Chandler because he's so good at being the sort of like Boy Scout he needs to be the FBI guy after them. I love everyone in that movie. It's great.
Todd, I'm sorry. Nick, do you have a different answer?
I do, actually. I think one of his best films, and it's a bit of a deep cut, I think it's the Bob Dylan documentary No Direction Home. What D.A. Pennebaker does is just capture moments and preserves them forever. And Scorsese just really takes a subject and dives so deep. He's almost like a paleontologist where he's just brushing away the dirt so we can see what the bones are. And I think it's the closest thing we'll get to any truth behind who Bob Dylan is, why Bob Dylan is, what Bob Dylan is, and not these – you know, oh, he's an enigma, or oh, he's this, or he's, you know, all this, you know, what he is and isn't. I think it's just pure and clear cut, and I think it's just really, really well done. And how, like, every documentarian that goes to make a documentary should at least watch this and then go and make their documentary, because I think it's one of the most perfect documentaries I've ever seen.
Well, I can't say that I've seen it, so it's hard for me to comment on it. I do have a documentary on my list, and it's Shine a Light, which is the Rolling Stones concert documentary, which I got to be honest with you. I was never a Stones fan, even though they are from my generation. And, you know, I know all the songs. I enjoy them, but I was never one of those people. I don't think I own a Rolling Stones album, you know, which is strange for somebody from my time period. But when I saw the Shine a Light documentary, I turned to my wife and I said, you know what? I think I finally get it. I understand why this band is considered by many to be the greatest band in the world. And I thought they were awesome, and that Scorsese, like, you know, shined a light on them that was very easy to see, you know, and respond to. If we're talking about narrative films, I think Scorsese's best films probably do have Robert De Niro in them, you know, and I would put Goodfellas in that category. But the one that doesn't have Robert De Niro in it that I think I like the best is Hugo, which is really kind of a salute to the movie industry itself, you know, the innovation and creativity that goes into making movies. And I thought it was really an effective use of 3D when 3D was a thing and everybody was doing it. And I thought, well, why is this in 3D? And then I saw this movie and I said, oh, this makes sense. And I liked it quite well. So that's kind of the way I would go about it. Like I said, I think most of his movies with De Niro are his best films. But outside of that category, with that filter on, those would be the choices that I have. Mm-hmm. Well, how about De Niro? Todd, let's start with you this time. You got a De Niro film without Scorsese that you would say is the best?
I went more in terms of, you know, favorite than necessarily the best.
Okay, sure.
I think it's one that would make a run, you know, make a run for the best, but yeah, it's definitely my favorite, and that it was mentioned a few minutes ago, Midnight Run.
Midnight Run, there you go.
I think Midnight Run, you know, De Niro is, I would say, technically the straight man there with Charles Grodin, you know, delivering most of the comedy. But, you know, De Niro does show some good comedic chops in there. It's, you know, a solid action. I love road movies. But I think at its heart, the main thing that makes Midnight Run work so wonderfully is the great comedic dynamic between Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro. So yeah, I could watch Midnight Run every day. So.
Well, that's good to hear. You know, I'm sure he would appreciate that. And it's a very effective film. We did that as a movie of the month, right?
We did. Yeah.
So good deal. Let me see. Who else have we got here? I'm sorry. Nick, how about you? You got a De Niro film that you're up for?
Yeah, for me, I think it's going to be Heat. And that's coming from somebody who the first two, maybe three times I saw Heat, I didn't like it. I thought it was terrible. And then something clicked last year, and I've been, like, obsessed with this movie. And there's just something about De Niro's performance that is just so cold-blooded and calculated and just – I think he's just firing on all cylinders on that one. So I got to say Heat.
That's fine. You know, that movie – I've watched it a couple of times. I like the movie very well. It is longer than I expected every time. I think, geez, how long is this damn movie? I'm usually fascinated with it and glad that I'm watching it, but I am frequently thinking, wait a second, is this really almost 3 hours? And the answer is yes, it is. Matthew, how about you?
I had a really hard time with this question because he's made so many great movies. But I'm just going to choose one that I keep coming back to, and that's going to be 1998's Ronin, in which he plays a freelance secret agent or spy. And they're after a thing, which you don't know what it is. And I think he's great through the whole movie. He's like the most professional operator in the movie. It's a great, straightforward performance, but he's so on point through the whole thing. And I love that movie, and it's got one of the great car chases of the 90s in it too. So it's a solid film, and I recommend that. And as a backup, I'm also going to say an underappreciated one of his, I think, is Wag the Dog.
Oh yeah,
also from the same era.
It's been a long time since I've seen Wag the Dog. I should go back and revisit it.
Yeah, that's a great De Niro performance, and it's also, I believe, an Academy Award-nominated Dustin Hoffman performance.
Yes, it is. He does his great impression of Robert Evans.
He's Robert Evans, yeah.
Yeah. That's also an interesting one to revisit, because, like, everything they do in that movie to, like, distract you, like, they're trying to distract the American populace from something that's happening, and you can just see that stuff still happening today. Like, it's not hard to imagine that those two people exist in the world and are constantly doing those things.
We've got to open our phones, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's right there in front of us most days of the week. Yeah, I had no trouble with this one at all, you know, thinking about it, because I immediately went to not only the what I think is his best performance, it's his best film, and it's the best film he's been in, including all the Scorsese films, and that's Godfather 2. That movie is, you know, it sits on a shelf all by itself, except for the first film that doesn't feature Robert De Niro, but features a character that Robert De Niro portrays. And then when the movie, when Godfather 2 shows up and De Niro appears on screen as Vito Corleone in his younger version, it's like everything that I saw in my head when I was reading The Godfather originally is right there, and I thought that he did a fantastic job. His Italian's great, so you should get some credit for that too. And he is just lethal. He never is over the top. He is always contained and subdued, and it's just like having a you know, a friendly snake, and you say, "I've got a friendly snake." Well, if it's a boa constrictor, you're in okay shape carrying it around. But if it's a rattlesnake, you say, "Yeah, that's not a friendly snake." And that's kind of the way Vito Corleone is. He may seem okay and safe on the outside, but he is just coiled violence waiting to explode. And he does a couple of times, but not in a way that is out of character. It's all very calculated. And you can see the calculation on his face in that whole performance. I just think that, you know, like I said, that's a great film. I love Todd's choice, too, though. If I was going to go with a Robert De Niro comic performance, I wouldn't be picking any of the Meet the Parents films. I'd be picking I'd be picking Midnight Run. You know, when he slams the phone down on his employer, so to speak, that was a great moment. And every time he confronts Dennis Farina, I just think, yep, that's the kind of, you know, confidence that you'd want to have, and the smart-ass comments that you'd want to make in those situations. And I thought he was great in that particular film. I hope we've given our audience a lot to think about and some movies that they'll be looking forward to. I once again appreciate everybody who has joined us this week for the show, and I want to give you a chance to plug whatever you think people might be interested in. So, Nick, let's start with you. You got something you want people to turn their eyes and ears to?
I do. If they could turn their eyes and ears over to rabbitholepodcast.com, there's a myriad of podcasts over there. I'm on two. One of them that Richard mentioned earlier, Lyrical Innuendo. Bubba Wheat and myself look at lyrics of music, and we determine if the songs are about sex, drugs, or just good old-fashioned rock and roll. And something a little bit newer, Jason Soto is a huge Mystery Science Theater 3000 fan, and rather than say, "Hey, Nick, here's like two or three of my favorite episodes, what do you think?" Instead, he invited me along, and we're watching every single episode ever made of the television show because I've never seen it. We are 12 episodes in. I've been having an absolute ball, and if you feel like joining us on that adventure, that show is called Play MST for Me.
Very nice. Like I said, I seem to remember that Jason had a show where they talked about Mystery Science Theater episodes years ago, and this is a nice innovation where you get a chance to experience it for the first time. Lucky you. That's always fun.
Yeah, it is. It's been a real blast.
Todd, what do you want people to listen to or see?
Well, of course, we've got lots of episodes of the Forgotten Filmcast that have been hitting. Just to kind of go back on a few recent ones, since Richard's the host of this show, I'll mention that he was on a recent episode where we talked about a film called Fool's Parade, starring Jimmy Stewart, George Kennedy. Yes, George Kennedy, Strother Martin, of course, and a very young Kurt Russell. So check that one out. Last week's episode, I was joined by Simon Appleton from the movie Mustache, where we talked about a movie with an awesome title called Amsterdammed. So that one is out. I am halfway through editing this week's episode, so it should be up by the time this episode posts. I'm joined by DJ Valentine, where we talk about a film that actually is from the same director as Fool's Parade. It just worked out that way. But this is a very different film, a Western from 1976 called The Last Hard Men, starring Charlton Heston and James Coburn. And then the week after that, I just recorded yesterday with Elwood Jones, where we are talking about a bizarre ripoff of The Exorcist starring Tony Curtis called The Manitou. So check those out.
Yeah, you've been busy.
Yes.
Matthew, have you been busy? You got stuff that we should turn our eyes and ears to?
Yeah. As always, the main thing that I do every week is I'm the host of the Awesome Friday podcast, in which me and my best friend Simon talk about two new movies every week, movies or series. Our last episode, we caught up with Aquaman 2 and The Beekeeper. And the episode that's about to go up will be ISS and The Taste of Things. You can find those wherever you can find podcasts. And you can also just head to awesomefriday.ca, or you can head to stretched.ca, which is my writing portfolio. I freelance for a number of outlets, and I've recently posted reviews for Exclaim and That Shelf, among others. And most recently, that would be I watched and reviewed the new Shogun miniseries for Exclaim. So,
oh, nice!
All that at those two places.
You've already seen that. Is it going to be worth my time and energy?
So I'm going to say that I liked but didn't love it.
Okay.
But I also seem to be in the minority on that front. Lots of people are saying it's, like, great. Most of my quibbles with it, most of my problems with it are due to some of the adaptational choices they made, because I love the book. And they changed around some stuff that I don't want to spoil it too bad, but, like, they changed some stuff that I think was a good choice executed poorly, if that makes sense.
Okay. Well, I am going to watch it because I was a fan of the original series. I read the book way back before the original series ran. That was the first project that I can remember seeing John Rhys-Davies in, and I really enjoyed the original miniseries. So when I heard that they were doing this, I thought, well, this should be interesting because they can probably do a little bit more and get away with a little bit more. I imagine that it's going to be closer to Game of Thrones than something that you would see on 70s TV.
So that is definitely accurate.
Okay.
The big change is that, you know, the original series in the book, Blackthorne, Richard Chamberlain in the miniseries, is very much the protagonist, and you're witnessing things through him. And in this miniseries, Torunaga is basically the protagonist. And it focuses much more on the court intrigue stuff, which I think is a good choice. But I think it leaves a pretty big gaping hole in the center of the sort of soul of the story. So, but again, like, it is totally worth your time. You should definitely watch it. It is gorgeous, and you cannot go wrong with Hiroyuki Sanada or Tadanobu Asano. They are both great. And Anna Sawai, who also just came off of Monarch, Legend of Monsters, is having a great 12 months. Like, this, she's really, really good in it. So, I think it's definitely, everyone should watch it. I'm a little colder on it than some people.
That's fine. And by the way, I want to give you props for getting all of those names flowing off of your tongue as if you say them all the time. I would struggle with each of those.
I'll do my best.
Each of those. Well, on my site, I've got the usual, you know, whatever I've seen in a theater recently is going to be reviewed there. I should have an upcoming podcast dropping from on Howard Kasner's Pop Art. I do have the show that Todd just mentioned that we did on another podcast. I'm going to go see David Lynch's Dune on the big screen this afternoon, so
nice.
You will be getting another post on that. I'm a Dune fanatic, so I'm all excited about the upcoming second part of Denis Villeneuve's films, and of course, I am not so much an apologist as a strong defender of Lynch's version. I think it's a great movie, and there's so much about it I appreciate, despite the fact that it is often derided as a flop, a failure, and something that should be wiped from the face of the earth. By the way, things that shouldn't necessarily be wiped from the face of the earth, despite everybody's opinion about it, I am not going to defend Madame Webb. But I am
my
going,
hand is raised too.
But I am going to say the hyperbole behind the hate is just ridiculous. It's not a good movie, but it is not the worst pile of crap in the history of movie making, and people who are saying so are just stringing together a series of adjectives and adverbs to make their point.
Yeah. My response to people who call any movie the worst movie ever is almost always, you need to watch more movies.
No, I mean, Madam Web, it's not good. I wasn't bored, but it's not good.
So there you go. We'll have those opinions up for everybody to look at there on the Kirkama Movie A Day site. Once again, I want to thank Nick and Matthew and Todd for joining me this week. I appreciate you on this little birthday excursion that we're taking. And we'll catch up with all of you next time on the Lambcast. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Oh, no.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell! Go to hell.
Be careful, it could go off for like no reason.